Welcome to another edition of the Neon Jazz interview series with tenor saxophonist Steve Heckman. He got a hugely informal yet profound education growing up in New York City in the 1960s, watching talent come through that city. These days, he is based out of San Francisco and stays very busy as one of the best names in jazz these days. Over our interview together, he discussed why he started out on the clarinet at 12, the many cats he has played with over the years, why it took so long to release his solo albums, and what is next for him, along with much, much more. Dig it, my friends.
Thank you for taking a little time to talk with me today. I appreciate it.
Oh, no problem. Thank you for asking.
Absolutely. Yeah. First of all, let me know what's been going on lately with you.
Well, my latest album, which is my fourth as a leader and second one done for Jazz Media Label, is doing very well, far exceeding my greatest hopes, hitting number 10 on the Jazz Week charts, being on the charts for almost 4 months, which is really nice. And there was another chart that I wasn't even familiar with, Roots Music hit number 3 on that, and then number 6 on another week. So apparently the DJs like it, which I
can't. It's a great album.
Well, thank you.
Absolutely. So you had a great backbone in jazz. You grew up in New York and watched that flourishing scene in the 60s. What was that like at such a young formative age to see all that going on?
Oh, it was fantastic. I mean, incomparable experience. I'm so glad I grew up in New York at that time. And interestingly enough, my progression in terms of my own playing probably went backwards. In other words, I was exposed to the avant-garde scene first. I was attracted to the energy and the freedom of it. And as a teenager, I think teenagers just go through a lot of stress and strain, you know, finding their way. And so it was a great outlet for me. I grew up in a family where there were very high academic expectations, a lot of pressure. So discovering jazz was kind of the greatest release of that pressure. I just found a sense of freedom, and especially with Coltrane and the avant-garde, I would say that just really appealed to a part of me at that time. Then over the years, as I got older, I wound up going to school in the Midwest in Illinois, University of Illinois, which had a great jazz scene under the leadership of John Garvey, and got to play with a lot of guys who went on to make names for themselves, like Jim McNeely, the pianist, and John Burr, bassist, who's gone on to play with Horace Silver, Stephan Grappelli, Tony Bennett. Learned to play bebop, I would say, in Illinois. Yeah. I've been out on the West Coast in the San Francisco Bay Area since the late 70s, and it's a very nice scene here. Pretty much anything you could ever want to hear is going on out here. I would say I've my interests lie probably more in the modern mainstream right now. I think I'm interested in trying to see how creative I can be still within the structures and the forms of tunes. So I think there's still like unexplored territory there. And I mean, one of the people that I really love is Lee Konitz, because he plays the same tunes over and over, but he's always exploring new aspects of them. And I'm just amazed at, wow, I never would have thought of playing that.
Yeah.
And so it's just like endless territory within those structures.
Who were some of the artists that you saw in New York that you remember that were really, like, mind-blowing sets?
Unfortunately, I never saw Coltrane because he passed away just as I was getting into him. But I did see Lee Morgan at Slugs a number of times, and I saw Monk maybe 3 or 4 times at the Village Vanguard, Gatto Barbieri, Pharoah Sanders, trying to think who else. Bill Evans.
Wow.
Oh, this is a fabulous experience that I had. I had a friend, Jeff Goldfarb, who's a trombone player. He got me onto my first professional gig with Roswell Rudd, the avant-garde trombonist. And he just knew everything that was going on in New York City at that time, which was the late 60s. Somehow he found out about a rehearsal in, one afternoon in this library, I think. It was Bill Evans' trio with Lee Konitz. And we just kind of snuck in, quiet as mice, and just took a seat. we were the only people there, and we were just watching the rehearsal. They paid no mind to us at all. And, I mean, what a fabulous experience.
Wow.
I wish I was probably too young to fully appreciate it, but I'm still awestruck when I think of just the experience itself.
Yeah. Well, in this day and era, with the ease of video and recording, if you captured that, that thing would be just pounded by people, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So at the age of 12, you started out on the clarinet, and then you moved your way into the alto and tenor sax. Why the clarinet in the beginning, and why did you move to the sax?
Well, the clarinet, that's an interesting story. I remember being put in instrumental music in seventh grade. People came around at the end of sixth grade giving us ear tests, and apparently I did well. I had no idea that I would wind up playing music at all. Mm-hmm. Then in that instrumental class, they play the sounds of various instruments. I really wanted to play the oboe originally, but because I was wearing braces, I was told that I would cut my lips to shreds. I was told that clarinet wouldn't be as bad. I'd only be cutting one lip to shreds, just the lower lip. And I liked the sound of the clarinet also. So that's pretty much how I got started. But a number of my friends were playing saxophone, and they were starting to play, get into jazz themselves. And I started to hear some jazz, and I thought, wow, that is really cool. And saxophone was a cooler instrument, so I didn't stop playing clarinet, but I added saxophone, alto, and then tenor. And I still play the same tenor that my dad bought me in 1965 at a pawn shop in the Lower East Side of Manhattan.
Wow.
And I remember we went into the store, and the guy brought out a shiny horn. I couldn't get a note out of it. And the guy went to the back of the store, brought out another horn, which wasn't as shiny, but I got a nice sound out of it. And that's what I play today. It's a Selmer Super Balanced Action, which is a highly sought-after horn. So I think the angels were looking out for me in terms
of
that horn coming into my hands.
Well, if there is ever proof that it's not what's on the outside, it's what's on the inside, you got it.
Well, thank you.
You know, I mean, you got the horn that had the sound, so there you go. That's the genie in the back of the shop for sure.
Right, right. And that helped me develop the sound in my head and what I was absorbing from all the people that I was listening to. I would say also, growing up in New York, there were at least three jazz stations.
Wow.
Fabulous. And I'd be just glued to those stations after I got home from school, just absorbing as much as I could. So it was a great place to grow up.
Absolutely. So your bio notes that you're self-taught, that you learned from folks like Alan Field, what did these teachers teach you that was so profound that made your music move in certain directions?
Well, the self-taught aspect is the fact that I got very frustrated with what they were attempting to teach me. They were saying, well, you got to learn these chords and these scales, and all of that is true. I think the teaching of jazz has improved significantly in the last five decades since I was a teenager, in that I think the studies are much more relevant to what is being played in a jazz tune, whereas my experience was that these chord progressions did not seem to be what I was hearing. I do see how they are related, but the samples, in other words, I recall being shown these chord progressions, and there'd be some examples that were written out by whoever wrote these books. But they were corny as hell, and I thought, well, this is not how I want to sound. Then I had an epiphany one day listening to Johnny Griffin, where I heard these chord changes. I don't want to get too technical, but 2-5-1-6 is kind of like the basic chord structure of many popular songs, and the I Got Rhythm changes, which are the basis for a ton of Charlie Parker songs. And kind of one of the backbone structures of jazz tunes and Great American Songbook tunes. Anyway, I heard that progression played by Johnny Griffin, and it's like, okay, now it all starts to make sense.
Yeah.
So in the sense of being self-taught, I think, the teachers tried. I can't say that I credit them with, maybe they pointed me in in a direction, but I didn't see the relevance of that direction. Really, I think it was from my listening that things started to click. And then I transcribed solos as a teenager. I transcribed using reel-to-reel tape. So you would slow the thing down. It would actually, the pitch would be an octave lower than what it would sound like. So Charlie Parker on the alto, it sounded like he was playing a baritone sax, but it slowed it down enough that I could pick out the notes one by one. Of course, I have to go back and forth, back and forth. But I did transcribe about six Bird solos as a teenager, some George Coleman solos, Coltrane's alternate takes version of Giant Step. So that is great training. I mean, it really gets your ear sharp.
So, yeah.
And then just seeing what these folks were doing, I started to integrate little bits and pieces into my own playing. So the improvisation part of my playing, I'd say, is primarily self-taught. I had good teachers in terms of technique as far as getting tone. I did study with Carmine Caruso, who's more known as a trumpet teacher for trumpet embouchure, but he also taught saxophone embouchure. And I think studying with him helped me really understand how to produce a clear sound. And I've been a stickler about that. I've always tried to get a clear sound on all of the instruments that I play, all the saxophones and the clarinet, and I think I've been fairly successful at that.
Absolutely. So speaking of success and in listening to the greats, obviously John Coltrane has been a huge influence on you. In your bio, you talked about you listening to Love Supreme over and over and over again. What was it about Coltrane's whole vibe that just hooked you?
Yeah, I listened to A Love Supreme every day after school through junior and senior year of high school. The power, particularly of that album, it was beyond just playing tunes. He wasn't playing tunes anymore. It was a spiritual experience. All I can say is that I felt the depth of it through my entire being. And I felt it was a transcendent experience listening to that. And Coltrane's sound, just the sheer sound of it, was so penetrating, unlike anything I've ever heard before. It was so intense and fully committed, 200% present. I've never heard Coltrane where it's not like he's giving it his all.
Yeah.
In great contrast to, you know, other horn players. And not to take away anything from all the other greats, and I know there's a number of albums with Coltrane with, I think it's Paul Quinichette and Al Cohen, Zoot Sims, these kind of four tenor things. I can't recall the titles offhand. I can't right now. But so you hear these other guys, Hank Mobley, and they're all, you know, bebopping away, and then Coltrane steps in, and his sound just pierces right through, and the intensity, it's just like everything is brought to a whole higher level. So
yeah.
That's been my experience with listening to Coltrane, just so refreshing and just so powerful, miles above everyone else that I've ever heard, really.
Yeah, if there was ever an album in the annals of jazz history that had the appropriate name, it was that album right there, you know, A Love Supreme.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that's what it was. Somebody had told me at one point, I can't remember who it was, that he had kind of tailored the making of this as though he was saying a prayer.
Right.
And it's one of the reasons why it was such a powerful album for him to make.
Right. And I think the world responded. I think
yeah.
The world got it.
Absolutely.
Interesting. I think they just, in the last few years, released some alternate takes of that,
yeah.
Which has Archie Shepp on it.
Wow.
And I think Archie himself admitted that it didn't really work.
yeah.
Minor notes. And I'm so glad they released the version that they did work, that they did release.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah. So if you had to pick your jazz religion, would it be bebop? Is that what you kind of lean towards more?
Well, I would call myself more of a post-bop person. I mean, or I'll call myself an eclectic. I mean, I think over the years, you've taken that Coltrane influence. I don't think I'm trying to sound exactly like him anymore. think I'm trying to find my own sound. Some reviewer, I think it was Dan Belosky from All About Jazz, said that I had like a matte finish, kind of a take on a melding of various people, including Train, Sonny Rollins, Dexter Gordon, Michael Brecker. I would say that's true, that I love all those people. As far as my own sound, well, the highest compliment that I get here in the Bay Area is when friends of mine tell me that they've heard a cut of mine on the radio and they've recognized my sound. So I'm taking that as a sign of that I have an individual sound that it, that people can pick up on immediately, which is, that's nice. Nice to know. I don't think one consciously, you know, plans that ahead of time, how, you know, well, I want to sound. Well, I guess some people might do that, but they're usually copying someone. Like, I want to sound like exactly like David Sanborn or Michael Brecker, and there's many, you know, quote-unquote clones around that, that are like that. I'm not sure that's such a great thing. I think it's better to find your own voice and, you know, certainly take bits and pieces of influences, but ultimately, I don't think it's a great idea to be a copy of someone else.
I would say the
last 15 or 20 years, I've seen a lot of that. I've seen a number of people come out who are copies of Kenny Garrett. Prior to that, there were a number of copies of David Sanborn. I don't know that anyone has successfully been a copy of Michael Brecker because he was so incredibly amazing. I hear a guy like Seamus Blake, who's excellent, and I hear that he's got some of Brecker's kind of influence in terms of his lines, which are gorgeous, but he's got his own sound, which is a bit darker and different and very distinctively him. And I'm okay with that. I'm great with that.
Speaking of originals, at 17, you got to play with Howard McGhee. What was that like?
Well, it was really nice to be recognized by someone of his stature, because I felt like I was just beginning to get into it. So when someone like that kind of picks up on my playing, I mean, that's the highest compliment. It's like, okay, that's great validation that I'm in the right direction. He heard something and he felt something from my playing. So I didn't do a lot of playing with him. It was just a few occasions. But I mean, between him and Roswell, just being recognized enough to be hired into their bands was great.
Yeah. And then in college, you played with Slam Stewart and Cy Zentner and Irby Green. That had to be, even taking it to a whole other level to learn from them at that kind of formative level of your education and your life, I would think.
Right. And those gigs were done in the college bands, the college big bands.
Yeah.
So I would say I didn't get to know those folks as, you know, as personally as I would have liked. It was a great experience, though. Cy Zentner was just the coolest guy, the easiest guy to work with. So was Irby Green. I worked in a couple of – at University of Illinois, they served as the pickup bands for the Dorsey bands. Both Dorsey bands were kept going even after the leaders had been long gone. Mm-hmm. The charts were preserved, and I believe Lee Castle, trumpet player, ran the Jimmy Orchestra, and Warren Covington ran the Tommy Orchestra, so I got to play in each of those. That's not really my thing, but as they were passing through, I was invited to be part of that. I don't really consider myself a big band player. It's just not I really like to solo. I really like smaller groups. So good experience along the way, but not my main bag.
Well, and then you've played with a lot of folks over the years and had a lot of experiences on stage collaborating. Is there any gigs or any people that you think, man, I learned a lot from that experience that kind of stands out for you?
Well, playing with Eddie Henderson, he used to live in the Bay Area, and so in the late, I think it was either 1979 to 80 or 81, he had a regular Thursday night gig that I would play, and he gave me a lot of freedom to stretch out, and he took a lot of freedom as well. I would say that would be one of the best experiences that I've had.
Yeah.
And young Benny Green, who was a 16-year-old high school student, was playing piano in that band, and of course we know how much success he's had.
Yeah.
That. But he was amazing at 16. And then let me, if I can just backtrack again, at 16 I also met Bob Berg, who also was almost fully formed at age 16, and I met him at a jam session at a friend's house and just blew my socks off. Amazing to hear him. And I would say he's been an influence as well over the years in terms of that intense sound. Let's see. There was another guy in the San Francisco Bay Area who's not with us anymore. Bishop Norman Williams was an alto sax player. I don't know if he ever really got known beyond the local area here, but he had a regular Sunday night session, and I played with him for about a year as well. And he would play fast, really up-tempo bebop tunes, so that helped me get my up-tempo chops together. I would say that was also a great experience. And recently, about a year and a half, almost 2 years ago, I had the honor of playing with the great drummer Jimmy Cobb.
Oh, cool. He's
in his early 80s now, and the only surviving member from the Kinda Blue album. And, of course, he's been playing continuously over the years. A local pianist, Larry Vukovich, put together a kind of a recreation of Kinda Blue with Jimmy Cobb. And a great alto player from Australia, Andrew Spate, who's been part of, I think he's been part of Cobb's Mob on a couple of albums with Eric Alexander. Good guy to check up on.
The one thing about Jimmy Cobb, I had the honor of speaking with him, and when he talked about that Kinda Blue session, it was just, I don't know that any of those guys ever foresaw that it was going to become as iconic as it did. It was just a day, or it was a couple of days where they just played as hard as they could, and it was brilliant, you know.
That's exactly the answer I got when I first walked into the back room where we were putting our cases and everything, and I first met him for that gig. That was my first question. How did that come about? And he said the same thing. They had no idea what it was going to become. And I specifically asked about the tune, I think it was Flamenco Sketches, because I noticed, I had to study that tune, and the length of the solos of Miles and Cannon and Train are different number of bars. And I asked him, well, was that pre-planned? He said, as far as he recalled, it just happened.
Yeah.
So they just felt it, you know.
Yeah.
Which amazing.
Which is probably just the way the entire album was. It was a feeling, and that was it. Became what it is. Is there anybody on your radar that you would like to play with in the world of jazz, like specifically, that you're like, man, I would love to jam or gig with that person?
There's, interestingly enough, it's some other tenor sax players. Grant Stewart is a guy that comes to mind, and I don't know if, well, he's not quite a household name yet. Incredible guy from Canada who's gotten a lot of influence from early Sonny Rollins. But this guy is so fluid, just brilliant. He's done a number of albums with Vincent Herring, the alto player, and I think called Reeds and Deeds. Well, I might be getting that mixed up with Eric Alexander. Anyway, Grant Stewart's got maybe a dozen albums under his own name, or maybe more, but just a superb player. Jerry Braganzi is another incredible tenor player who I love. I'd like to do something with Benny Green again, kind of a reunion kind of thing. Logistically, it's been difficult to get that to happen. We have talked about it over the years, and it's not happened yet, but that he is another guy that I would love to. And Eddie Henderson as well. Matter of logistics.
Yeah. So you mentioned that you really like to do solo work with, you know, Born to Be Blue, Live at Yoshi's, John in the Mind. When you think about your solo work, is there a particular album or period of time where you think that was prolific. I learned a lot, and it just kind of comes to you as that was a very big period of creativity for you.
Well, the first album, with John in mind, was a major breakthrough in that, let me back up. These days, kids in their 20s are putting out albums. Now, when I was coming up, I dare not even think of that. I didn't feel ready at all. I felt like, oh, I really have to have something to say. And so I didn't feel like I was at that point until I was in my mid to late 40s, really, which is kind of late. But I think the breakthrough, just putting it out there, was a big step for me.
Yeah.
So I would say I learned a lot about that. I think I had a lot of fear about judgment, external judgment. I tend to be generally an introverted person, and I think putting myself out into the world like that was a bold step for me. But I'm very glad I did it, and everything became much easier after that.
Yeah.
Getting into play at Yoshi's, I was chosen over 50 other competitors to be part of this, trying to recall the name of the local jazz organization that sponsored groups on Monday nights, like once a month, Jazz in Flight.
Yeah.
And so I was chosen as the band to perform at Yoshi's. So that, and they recorded that live, and it came out great. So that was my second album. I'd say the third and fourth albums, which were both recorded at the same time, about 6 years ago, with Howard Alden, I would say they represent a different aspect of my playing in that Howard comes from more of a traditional background. I kind of felt like I needed to kind of meet him halfway, so I really toned down my intensity. I would say my first two albums were much more Coltrane-ish in terms of sound and my intensity. And it was a nice experience to kind of just relax, get more into the melodies, get into it like a darker tone, and I'm not sure I'm going to stay in that direction per se. As a matter of fact, I actually have another recording in the hopper that's being mixed right now, which is of all Coltrane music. This was done in a concert tribute to Coltrane, recorded about a year and a half ago. And so that's back up to that Coltrane intensity. So I don't know, maybe I'm a chameleon, but that's the way it is.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you could climb into a time machine and go back in time and meet one jazz musician or see one gig, who would you meet? Where would you go? What would you want to see, or what would you want to talk to them about?
Well, it would definitely be Coltrane, no question. What would I want to talk to him about? That is a good question. Probably technical things that your audience wouldn't be interested in, like mouthpieces.
Yeah.
Like, what opening mouthpiece did you use, and what kind of modifications did you make to it, and how is your embouchure? How did you get that sound?
Yeah.
Were you influenced by Dexter Gordon in terms of his sound, or was he influenced by your sound? That's a question that I don't know the answer to, because I hear similarity in terms of that clarity. So probably very technical questions. I mean, I've read about how he had the inspiration for A Love Supreme, and my understanding is that he was cold turkeying upstairs in his room for days and days, and then this music came to him.
Interesting. Very interesting.
Hard to say what I would ask if I were in his presence. I did have a dream that I was playing with him on a circular stage, which was an incredible dream, one that I didn't want to wake up from.
That's cool. Very cool.
About 20 years ago.
Well, speaking of dreams, what is the greatest thing about waking up every day?
Greatest thing about waking up? Well, I'm in good health. I feel like I've been given a great gift. I mean, I work hard. I think that musical success is 95% sweat equity and 5% inspiration. By that, I mean, I think the more one immerses oneself in the tasks of playing and communicating with the horn, communicating with the music, communicating with the tunes that have been written or that I'm writing. That's the sweat equity, but it's not like hard work. It's fun work. It's discovery. I'm discovering things about the music, discovering things about myself, just broadening my way of looking at music and the world. So I'd say the best thing is to constantly be aware of that blessing, because I know a lot of other musicians who I hear them trying, and I guess this might sound judgmental. I often don't feel the emotional aspect of it coming from them, that technically they might be good, but I'm not moved. And to me, the whole point of music is to be moved emotionally. If it doesn't do that, I don't really see what the point of it is.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I see people who, it seems like they're going on for years and decades, and I just don't feel it. Or I don't know what they're listening to. Or maybe they've not listened to themselves objectively. It's great to record yourself and really hear. I think the first few times I did that, I was in shock. Like, oh, my God, is that how I sound? I got to change this. I got to change that. I got to change this. But that's good. It's good to see yourself in the mirror. So, that's a rough question to answer. I hope I've answered it.
Yeah, absolutely, without a doubt. What is next for you?
Well, I think next is getting that Coltrane tribute finished and releasing that. And I also have a duo album that has already been recorded with Matt Clark, who is the pianist on all four of my CDs, who I just love, and I really have great wishes for him to become more widely known, because I think he's fantastic. And so it's very nice. I've never done a duo album before. It's very intimate, and I think we have a nice mix of material. So I've got two things in the hopper. Another thing that I'm working on right now is this is totally different from bebop, from straight ahead jazz. I have pretty broad interests. I also play in a group called the San Francisco Chamber Jazz Quartet, which is piano, bass, drums, and myself. But we do kind of jazz meets classical. And for that group, I've written a number of tangos. I've gotten influenced by Astor Piazzolla, who plays the bandoneon, which is kind of a small accordion. And I never thought I'd like the accordion, having grown up in New York and playing in wedding and bar mitzvah bands with the cheesiest sounding accordions. But over the years, the sound has changed, and Richard Galliano, great accordion player, but the bandoneon has a hipper sound to me. Anyway, so I've written a number of tangos, and I have a friend of mine who's an arranger. He's putting together an arrangement for string quartet, and I was thinking I might perform these on clarinet, which means a lot of woodshedding on that instrument for me. But I'm thinking about putting something out along those lines, kind of inspired by Paquito de Rivera. He's got an album called The Clarinetist, where he's got strings and clarinet playing Latin American music, and it's just gorgeous stuff.
Right on. So let's say we get together here in about 10 years in 2025 and we talk, and I ask you, what are you happy that has happened in the last decade of your life? What are you going to look forward to talking about in an interview?
Well, I would say if those three projects that I've talked about have come to fruition, sooner rather than later, that would be a good thing.
Yeah.
I tend to get sidetracked. I get invited to be a sideman on other people's projects and other people's gigs, recording sessions, and that I usually put my own stuff on hold when I do that. So I think my goal is to be a little more focused. I just am going to continue working on improving my saxophone playing, continuing to write more. Let's see here. That's a hard question, really. I don't know that I plan my future ahead that specifically. I think I try to stay awake and alert and cognizant of directions that interest me and that open up and explore them and see where they lead. But I don't have a global vision of changing the whole face of music. And I think you had put in your email when you had asked about this interview about how I felt I had affected the landscape of current music or something like that.
Your impact on the world of jazz, yes.
Right, and I was grappling with that question for quite a while and very flattered. I don't know that I don't think I've changed the impact of the landscape other than by inserting my presence into it, and then maybe in a very small way I've added to the vast kaleidoscope of these many different viewpoints that people have. I don't think that I've created major innovations in the music per se. I don't know, some people might say that I'm a throwback. I mean, I do want to keep carrying the torch of music that's accessible to the public. I do hear a lot of current music that's quote-unquote cutting edge. It's very angular. It's oftentimes in odd time meters. And it's very clever and interesting and highly creative. And I would like to be able to do some of that. But there's a downside to it. I've listened to an album recently where basically the person said, I'm only willing to do standards if I, you know, reharmonize them and put them in different rhythms. But after the third or fourth tune listening, I got to say it was kind of exhausting.
Yeah.
Yes, it was hip, and yes, it was creative. But just following what's going on was tiring.
Yeah.
So, and there's something very refreshing just about playing things straight ahead and... And as I was saying earlier, through one's improvisation, making it creative in that way, coming up with new lines, new ways of making the changes. I don't know. I don't tire of that. I think the people that I'm talking about tire of that, and they're certainly entitled to their viewpoint about how music should be done. So maybe I'm more of a mainstreamer. And maybe my preservation of that is my contribution to the local, to the landscape of jazz today.
Absolutely.
I don't know. I'm curious. Do you have a take on what that is?
I think the beauty of, just like you said, you had a friend that picked out your style. I can pick out your style as well. I think you've added a distinct voice to a tapestry of music that I think is one of the finest that's ever been created in this country. And I think everybody has going from Rollins all the way down to current people like Chris Bowers, I think there's a wide range of voices that go into this art form. And you're one of those voices that's very distinct, that's pushing the craft and keeping it moving in the right direction. And I think there's a lot to be said about the fact that you waited for a long time to get to a point where you wanted to do solo work. I think that only bodes better for you in maturity in your sound. And, I think it's awesome. I think there's a lot of great ways that you move and you have moved the jazz world personally. So,
wow.
And that's why I wanted to explore more of your background and who you are and where you're going and just kind of get into, and that's why I like to do these kinds of interviews to kind of get into your head to see where you're at with your music, how it came about. And there's a lot of things from the early years in New York to what you're doing solo and even the collective with the chamber that you're doing. It's great. It's growth. It's amazing stuff.
Well, thank you. I'm very flattered. Thank you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that was really your answer there about my impact. I think that was kind of where my stopping point was going to be. I think defining that is beautiful. I think that's the official end of the interview, so to speak, if that works for you.
Oh, yes, fine. Yes, that seems like a perfect point.
Steve, hey, man, it was great to talk with you.
Excellent. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for listening and tuning in to yet another Neon Jazz interview, where we give you a bit of insight into the finest players in New York, Kansas City, San Francisco, and spots all over America, giving fans all that jazz. And thanks to to the great Steve Heckman for his enthusiasm and fine music. If you want to hear more interviews, go to Famous Interviews with Joe Domino on the iTunes Store, or you can always visit theneonjazz.blogspot.com for all things Neon Jazz. Until next time, enjoy the music, my friends.
Neon Jazz.